Blog Talk Radio.
The motherfucking saga continues.
Yo, yo, what's up, world? It's Badass Thuggin' like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cuff. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond.
What's up with it, y'all? Man, don't change that sound. This your player partner, the legendary Cocaine. And you tuned in live to Off the Cuff Radio. Better not touch that sound. Wiggling.
Yeah, yeah, this is Cassidy the Hustler. And right now, you listening to the Guillotine. Show them the respect they deserve, man. Off the Cut Radio, man. Y'all already know how they doing it, man. I need y'all to stay tuned. They've been doing it for years. So show them the respect they deserve. And you heard it out of bars, mom. Easy.
Keep it moving like this. Yo, this your boy Rampage. You're not rocking with the best. With Off the Cut Radio. Classic. History. Fix your face to all you haters. We off the cuff, baby.
What's up, everybody? This your girl, Bonnie Dollars, the queen of trap, representing Crenshaw, and you are now tuned in with Off the Cuff Radio. What's up?
What's up, y'all? This is Miss Irresistible, giving a shout-out to the live show on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio, and I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
Hmm. What it ain't, what it do. Chilly Chill from that original Lynch Mob. Off the Cuff Radio, always where it's at on Friday night. West West, y'all.
Shake it, shake it, shake it.
Jack Sound Beat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. What it do, y'all? It's your boy Kid Gag the Great, and you're now tuning in to episode 427 of Off the Cuff Radio, live and direct, man. Sponsored by Buddy Boy Entertainment, sponsored by Jesse's Boutique, sponsored by Coors Financial, Da Vinci Clothing. I got my host T-Max with the facts on board tonight, and we have a special show on board.
What's going on, y'all? Thursday Night Thunder, OTCF in the building. Shout out to our co-host in spirit, El Alatan, Male Agent Chiller. It is I, myself, T-Max with the facts, along with your main pilot, the one who's navigating us through the niceness, King Eric. And like he said, we are about to take flight on one of the most dopest, one of the mostest flights tonight, man. King, tell our people about who we got as a guest tonight.
First of all, man, I want to send a big shout-out to the big homie Fleetwood, man, for making this connection happen. And happy birthday to
you. Yes, yes. Happy birthday, Fleet.
Without him, man, guys, without Fleetwood, man, Off the Cuff Radio wouldn't be at the pinnacle of where it is today. So big birthday salute and shout-out to him for making this connection happen. This brother right here, you probably know him. Many people know him within the circle as the nephew of Dougie Fresh. This brother here is talented, man, representing the Bronx, New York, from his storytelling ability, from the way he, you know, he's like a straight-up wordsmith when it comes to his wordplay. And, you know, with the single we just played right there, it shows his diversity as well. And when he put the name Hitman on his name, that goes to show you right there that there's going to be some more hits coming. And for him to come through and build with us along with the legendary Smooth B, he's going to be joining us in 5 minutes. Let's all welcome K. Davis, the Hitman, y'all.
Yo, yo,
yeah.
yo, what's good, y'all?
What's going on, man?
What's up, my brother?
Hey, I'm chilling, man. I'm having a blessed night. I'm here. I mean, I apologize about the last interview, but we're here now. We're going to get it popping today.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Definitely, man.
Yes, sir. Things happen.
Yeah, I was actually on a mini tour when that went down, so I was trying to rush out of the venue to do the interview, and then, you know, shit got twisted, and I was with Smooth B that night as well. That's how we made the connection with Smooth. Smooth was my big homie, uncle, everything. He like family, you know what I'm saying? We build real hard. We build real hard on the music tip and on the personal tip. You know, when you can build with somebody on a personal level, it's beyond music now. You know what I mean? Beyond music. You know, like a guidance.
Definitely, man. And one thing about a hit, man, is that you definitely got a full clip of niceness with the lyrical ammunition and articulation. You're definitely you know, descended from hip hop royalty, of course, you know, with your Uncle Doug,
yeah.
And of course, have a Smooth beat. Mm-hmm. So it's already, it's in your genes with the musical genius that you've expressed.
Right.
We're so elated. We're so excited to have you here. I guess we go ahead and get it popping like we normally do. You know, tell us a little bit about yourself in terms of what's, you know, part of, you know, in terms of what you, where you represent the Bronx, you know, how you came into this culture, this thing called hip hop that we know and love. And
mm-hmm.
Hey, the floor is yours. Let's get it.
Yeah, my name is K. Davis, the Hitman, real name Kareem Davis. I kept it real. I was formerly known as Manson Bates, you know, a little stage name. Started doing hip-hop around, 90. I was a little nigga in high school, junior high school, whatever. What started me off with hip-hop was the culture, the way they was living. Like, people was living this. I was seeing them on a BLS van, and, you know, of course, Doug, he was always the shining star, the family star. I just followed him in them footsteps, but in my own way. You know, I was turned onto the streets early, but I still kept my hip-hop roots. And I just like to make people have fun, and I love to see people enjoy themselves. So when I bring my music to the table, I'm bringing, like, life to the table. If the party's dead, I'm going to come liven it up, no matter where it's at. I mean, I've been doing it for so long. I know that I go up in spots where everybody on hold, you know, people on the wall, girls sitting down. When I'm on that stage, they getting up. There's something about the voice that... The voice that, you know,
mm-hmm.
that energy and that voice. I got to go, I, you know, I'm a slim dude, you know what I'm saying? I'm tall, slim dude. But it's like, the bullhorn voice is amazing to see, like, damn, this guy's voice is crazy. And then, you know, lyrically, I try to be detailed as possible and simple. Because, you know, we got the Nas already. We got the Eminems. We got the Cannabises. We got them lyrical dudes already. So we don't need no more lyrical dudes. We need a different dude. You see? A lot of artists don't understand that it's good to be different. That's what keeps the culture running. Like, if you've got a car and you can't have the same wheel bearing on your car, you gotta switch it up a little bit. Get a brand new wheel bearing. Matter of fact, just, you know, get some different wheels now so the car keep looking new. You know what I'm saying? So I add on to the game like that, man. You know, that's me, Kay Davis.
And one thing when you speak on it, Kay, when you deal in the, and that's a perfect analogy in terms of an automotive ride as it goes into, you know, rap articulation, because there's certain levels when you're dealing with, you know, your axles, you know, your wheel bearings, you know, when, because you actually, you have to replace it, because where that turn comes into the culture, the music itself is about evolving. You know, it's all about being able to push the boundaries of where it was before. Now, when you talked about what it was in the 1990s when you started, obviously we're looking at that very kind of pivotal period in a roughly three-year area between, we're looking at NWA dropping Straight Outta Compton in 88, but we're also simultaneously seeing the pro-black movement in terms of the, you know, with KRS, you know, of course, the self-destruction, you know, Stop the Violence movement, you know, of course, you know, West Coast All-Stars, Public Enemy, all of that. You know, so we're, you know, X-Clan, you know, everything. So we're looking at this culmination of it. So we're still looking at hip-hop at that particular time. It's still a very politically active and social commentary in terms of where we're seeing that change really go into the street level. What was it like for you during that time in terms of coming in and really watching where it was and how it was really, as you saw from your eyes and ears what it was, and then when you decided to take it to your level of, you know, keeping it with more of the party vibe?
Well, I seen it as being, you know, I didn't want to add, I mean, I came out as a hardcore battle rapper. I was a battle rapper. Mm-hmm. I was always been a battle rapper. I battled everything in the Bronx. I battled whatever I seen that rap, and I was beating people. So I knew that me coming in the game as a battle rapper and as a, you know, a quote unquote gangster rapper, I can do that because that's where I come from. I mean, it's easy to do. It's like, you know, that's me. But I felt like I didn't want to come like Doug, because Doug is more of an entertainer. So I wanted to come in the middle, basically, like, I wanted to be a person who could walk without a shadow. When you see me. It's not a shadow. I think Smooth is on the line, too. You can let Smooth on the line. He's on the line right now. Trying to get through.
Okay. All right, I'm about to bring him in now.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, I didn't want to be nobody's shadow, man. So I just had to make my own path and my own style. I learned from Smooth and Doug, and they taught me to be original. Got to be original at all costs. You know what I'm saying?
Definitely. They talk about being from the Bronx. What up? Hello?
Yo.
Smooth.
What
up, bro?
Yo. What's up? Y'all can hear me?
We can hear you.
Yes, sir.
We can hear you. What's going on with you?
All right, what's good?
Lounging, man. Great to have you with us, legend. What's going on?
Hey, man, first of all, I want to send a good salute to you getting your plaque, man. That was a beautiful thing.
Thank you.
Yes.
Oh, man, beautiful, man. Thank you so much, man. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. Yo, you got my brother, man. You got my nephew right there, man. You know what I'm saying? K. Davis, the head man. Huh? And let's celebrate this. So what's good?
Hey, listen, man. It's about Smooth, because Smooth taught me a lot. He taught me, like I was saying, you know, I'm glad he's on the line so he can hear this. Smooth taught me the game. He taught me the game, and I, like I told you, when you talk to a legend one-on-one, it's personal now. It's beyond industry, you know? So whatever I do in the game, I learned from Smooth how to be myself and be different. You know, Smooth went platinum 4 times in 1 year. Who does that?
Mm-hmm.
Who does that? Mm-hmm. The floor is yours, Smooth.
He's
not going to do it.
Man, thank you, man. You know what I'm saying? All praise due to the Most High, man. You know, You know, myself, I can do nothing, man. You know what I'm saying? It's the inspiration of the Most High and of the people. You know what I'm saying? Y'all gotta want that flavor. And when I feel that y'all want that flavor, then it comes forth. You know what I'm saying? But everything is in its time. And I couldn't have planned this. You know what I'm saying? All I could do is keep busting my pen. And I got loads of ammunition. You know what I'm saying? I've been writing for years. You know, the fact that I might not have been more or less like up front in the public's eye, whatever, with new material. I've been blessed to have previous material continue to play throughout the years. But it was just time for me to come forth as the legendary and let them know what I do and that I'm still here, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, man, absolutely. And one thing about both of you being both, I mean, just the most respected and revered representations of what this culture entails. You have obviously one artist who, you know, coming in, which is Hitman, you know, starting from a young age. But he also, you know, going years out. But he also has somebody, which is Self Smooth, who was a distinguished veteran who already understood the ins and outs of the business. We pretty much saw rap music really come into form in the early 80s, around 84. Of course, you being one half of the legendary Nice and Smooth with Greg Nice, you know, you all were part of that era in terms of really seeing it really develop. What was the business style like? What did you all learn in the early days of the business when you all first came in that you were passed to, you know, Hitman as he started his journey into it?
Yeah, man. Well, you know, This it is how would they say what I learned early was that it is better to understand than to be understood. All right, I'm gonna say that again. Mm-hmm. It's better to understand than to be understood, because when you embark upon this game from an artist perspective, you're often not understood. You're not understood by your general peers in the beginning. Like, people don't see the struggle part. They only see the end result. And so they don't see what you got to go through, the sacrifice you have to make, the time you got to put in, you know, those lonely moments when nobody believes in you and all of that type of thing. You know what I'm saying? Which forces you to continue to believe in yourself. And whenever you can come across somebody that could just spark you with a little inspiration, like I was blessed to be around. I grew up around Melly Mel and all of them. You know, they all lived in my neighborhood. And I would see them frequently coming up. And then once I really started getting into it, I'd talk to them. I'd walk up to them and I'd tell them, you know, who I am and what I'm trying to do or whatever. And they just always embraced me, man, because they would see me. They'd see me at the jams or whatever. Like, oh, yeah, I know you, little man. Whatever. Yeah. All right. I see you, you know. And then it just developed. So by the time we actually made music, it was funny. Like, Greg used to be around Scorpio from the Furious Five. And I used to be around Dynamite. Shout out to Dynamite and Mel, you know. And it just was one of those things. So once we teamed up, it was like we were the Bronx own, you know what I'm saying? And I remember Scorpio told us one day, we had just did the song Skill Trade. And he liked it. He was like, yo, man, yeah, y'all carrying tradition. So he said, I'm gonna give y'all the banner, man. You know, hold the Bronx down. And that was just so honorable coming from him. And, you know, that's Scorpio, who was originally Mr. Ness, you know, from the 3 is 5. And once he told us that was like a battery in our backs. And then we just kept going, man. And you know, but from the industry perspective, it's come a long way. It's come a long way, you know. It's come from not even being respected as a true art form to being the highest grossed art form and shit, basically the most respected, you know, at least from a monetary standpoint. So it's crazy. But to see it from humble beginnings is breathtaking.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, it started, you know, in the Bronx, 1420 Sedgwick, you know what I'm saying?
You know, this is pretty much, you know, this is where it started at. Well, in terms of where, you know, a lot of historians would say that's really where we saw it start. August, I want to say 11th, 1976, if I have my days correct, if I have my date correct.
Right.
So, I mean, tell us about the Bronx to where y'all represent, man, because there's like so many. I mean, we got to shout out everybody. We got to shout out University Heights. We got to shout out Fordham, Jerome Ave. You know, we got to shout out Ford.
Oh, yeah.
You know, 183rd, you know, Cypress. I mean, tell us about,
come
you know, where y'all represent.
Come on.
Yeah,
you
got to come
on. Yeah,
man.
Definitely, you know. Oh, man, listen, man. I definitely represent Finley Ave, 165th, 183rd, and Webster. 233rd and Harper, Eden Wall Projects, White Plains Road. I lived all over those places, all over the Bronx. And as a child growing up, I originally started seeing everything around 165th Street. And then we moved, and I moved by Mount Eden, Townsend Avenue. And then I got a chance to go to this club called the Sparkle. You know what I'm saying? So I'm talking about the first hip-hop jam that I went to was in Taft Schoolyard, and I was 11, and it was just amazing. And that's the first time I saw Flash. Grandmaster Flash was DJ Flash back then, and DJ Cool Herc. And I was a kid, man, and my boy, he was like 13, 14 years old. He took me to the jam, and, you know, I got my ass whooped because I missed my curfew that night. And that was my first ass whooping for hip-hop. And that's when I became a hip-hop junkie, dude. I couldn't not go, you know, because I had to be a part of that shit. I fell in love with it, you know. So I repped the Bronx hard, man. You know, I mean, come on, man. I'm the Bronx own, man. I love it, you know what I'm saying? And you know, I'm out west now, you know what I'm saying? A little more mature, raising my family and all of that. But, you know, I fucks with the New York. Come on, man. Anytime I'm on the East, you see me. I'm quite visible in the hood. So that's all it is, man. It's a beautiful day. It's different. It's different now than it was. You know, I don't see a lot of the same people. I damn sure don't see a lot of the same businesses. Things have changed. But, you know, the essence of it is all still the same. Yeah.
Definitely.
I love Harlem, man. Come on, man. Everybody. Yeah.
Definitely, man. And we wanted to ask Kay Davis, you know, Kay, this as well, man. Davis, when you grow up out there in the Bronx, when you look at all the elements that will mold you into the MC that you are today, from the battling to all those businesses, all the mainstays, the foundations, you know, the landmarks that would leave such an indelible print on making you who you are today. When you look at that nostalgia, where some artists today tend to forget about those elements that make them who they are, how important is it? Did you really understand the history that you were living in at the time in terms of the impact that it would ultimately have on the culture and yourself?
Oh, yeah, I definitely did. You know, I grew up around West Farm Road and Freeman Street and Bronx River, so them areas is where the jams is going on, and I knew that there was something special in them buildings. You know, when you see everybody mm-hmm. crowding around and they getting excited, carrying crates, and I see the hustle and the struggle that made the, you know, hip hop special. You know, and the foundation of hip hop basically is just the culture. People forget about the culture, and the young dudes don't know about the culture, so they disrespect it. You know, I feel like the culture is what keeps you, it keeps longevity in you. You got to look at where it came from to where it's at now. If them dudes back in the days wouldn't been carrying them crates, Red Parrot, the Rooftop, all them clubs that was happening, Skate Key, if them things ain't happened, it wouldn't have been this right here. It wouldn't have been none of this. It would have been cut off at the legs, you know what I'm saying? So I believe that hip-hop is rooted from a struggle, a way of out. You know, a way out, people trying to figure out what they're going to do in one day. Okay, let's go have a block party. Everybody get together and play some music and dance. And then, the MC came on the microphone. Yo, clear the ropes. Oh, he sound good on the microphone. Now you got rapping. You see what I'm saying? So I believe that the culture is definitely grounded and is strong. But people got to also remember where it came from. You can't dismiss history or you won't have a future. You understand?
Mm. That part.
Yeah, And I think what happened too with commerce, I think what happened too is like commerce is a good thing because it builds economics and, you know, it makes jobs and it puts people on. But we also get to that point where we deter from what we're supposed to do, and it turns into promote commercialism, and nobody's benefiting, just the people that's distributing the music. And they don't even look
okay.
like us. You know
something? I'm going to say something real fast. You sparked the flame. I ain't in the country. You sparked the flame. Understand this. They turned this into a corporation. A corporation.
Right.
They allowed, no disrespect, they allowed the white boys to get a hold of that microphone. See what I'm saying? And they allowed them to try to duplicate and like how mimic us. You know, so now it's not as fun as it was when you had the vinyls and the cassettes and you selling records and it was small black-owned businesses. You understand? Now it's like it's a distributing situation, you know, politics and it's been that, but it's more of a business, like, you know what I'm saying? Am I clear? Like, it's more of a business. They took the fun away from the shit. I mean.
Yeah, and we talked about this on the show. Yeah, we talked about this on the show before, Kay, and Smooth, about how as the industry changed, because we, depending on who you talk to, because when you're looking at the different iterations of when hip-hop came, you know, we really looked at the party era in the 80s, then, which 85 with LL, Run DMC, then we kind of jump into 87 with Public Enemy, Yo Bum Rush the Show, which brought more of the, you know, commentary, of course, the social commentary. Then we get into another Bronx legend, KRS-One, you know, with Boogie Down Productions, of course, him, Scott LaRock, D-Nice, all of them. You know, I mean, then the next year, 88, we got another Bronx rep, Split Rick coming in, you know. So it's like we're seeing all of these different parts.
It's evolving every year.
Yeah, and I mean, Smooth, what was it like to see a lot of these guys that you were coming up with? Because this is we're not even getting the guys like Fat Joe and, you know, Diamond D becoming prevalent yet. You know, of course, two alumni of the distinguished, you know, legendary DICT crew. So it's like this is still a couple of years before these guys really come in the game. You know, years before French Montana represented the Bronx. I mean, what was it like seeing a lot of these guys? When did you all realize you were like, just like QB, just like Brooklyn, just like Queens? When did y'all realize in the Bronx where it started that you all were like really, really cooking with something in terms of what you all were bringing?
Yeah, I mean, yo, you know, that's a good question. You know, the thing was, you know, we constantly like. It's funny. I put it this way. There was a club. There were many clubs, but there were one particular club called the Latin Quarters, right?
Yeah.
And all of our peers, you know, all of our peers used to be at the Latin Quarters. You know what I'm saying? And it was like, it was something like, it seemed like once you started to, once you was mastering your craft, it seemed like once you came to the Latin Quarters, for some reason, it's that atmosphere, you end up getting a record deal or some shit. Because it was like out of us and Rick and Dana Dane and Kane. It was like we were, and Biz, well, Biz, Ben had it, you know, he was one of the first ones to have a deal out of our crew. But, you know, like, you know, growing up back then, you went to every borough. It was like we were from the Bronx, but we traveled everywhere for hip-hop. We go out to Brooklyn. Brooklyn cats will come into the city. You know what I'm saying? But, like, again, the Latin Quarter seemed to be a melting pot. So it was like being in the Latin Quarters and being in that circle, we got a chance to hear a lot of the people's, a lot of the dope artists' demos before the world would hear them. You know what I'm saying? And so, I mean, I met Eric B. back then. I met Eric B. back in 1986. You know, when he first met Rakim, you know, it was 85, actually, late 85, when he first hooked up with Rakim, you know. And so I was with Eric B. the first time he played Check Out My Melody in the Latin Quarters. And he cool DJ Red Alert was the first one to spin Check Out My Melody. He actually gave it to Red Alert. He gave him the test presses, and I was right there with him when he handed Red Alert the test presses. check out my melody, you know? And so at a point, it seemed like out of everybody, Nice and Smooth was the last ones to come out as far as the crew, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, what started to make us realize that it was a collective was that, you know, like I said, we were seeing everybody and hearing their demos before they came out and getting an opportunity to see how the world would react towards them and just getting a chance to watch, having a bird's eye view of how even our peers would handle their success. So it was just a constant learning experience, you know what I mean? But it was more of like a age bracket. We was realizing, like, because you got to remember, before us was Mel and the Crash Crew and Treacherous 3 and all of those and Fantastic Romantic 5 MCs and the Cold Crush Brothers. And those were the ones that all of us watched. You know what I'm saying? We all learned from them. Mm-hmm. And so, but they didn't have, a lot of them didn't get the commercial success as far as records. Only like Mel and them, you know, they made records, Treacherous 3, Crash Crew, you know, but we would see those guys. You know, if you went to Harlem, you would see Kumo D walking down the street. You know, it just was a bug out, man. And so now our era. So after Doug and Rick came out, you know, they was our age. And so then following up with Rick and Doug was like Dana and different cats. And so, you know, and they was coming out before us, but like I said, they were our peers. So the collective was developing. It just was developing. And then we were just like, oh, now it's our era. You know, it's you know, our crew, the next cats to carry the torch. So, you know, it's just a beautiful thing, you know. You know, and the industry was as it was, you know what I'm saying, just trying to, you know, take your head off. You know what I'm saying? But you had to have tough skin, mm-hmm. man. And you had to, you know, had to be able to endure, you know.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. To listen to both of you reminisce with such fond memories of it, because we all, you know, we all look at this era with such a reverence, because it was strictly about back then. It was all about the delivery. It was all about it was really just about you being original. It was about you really having a presence. It was all about repping it right. Shout out, you know, to our big OG out in Oakland, the legendary Richie Rich, and he would talk about the politics of the Bay rappers out there back in the day. You know, and he would say basically the politics were stringent out there, like you weren't even getting in the studio until the OGs in the street knew you were ready to get in there and rep it right.
You always had to have a rep.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. And there were rules set in place. You know, like you said, going back to originality, that wasn't just a word thing. It wasn't like, yo, you got to be original or whatever, whatever. No, it was carried out. So if you got on a stage anywhere and your name was too close to somebody else's name, that's an automatic battle. You know what I mean? And so, you know, because you had to make a name for yourself. So it was like, yo, hold up, dude. You trying to sound like me? You trying to be like me? Well, let's battle on it. And then it was like, no, straight up. If you battled, you could rhyme. You know, it could be a breakdance battle. I mean, the whole culture was experiencing that, you know, down to graffiti artists. You know what I'm saying? It was like, if you wasn't original enough or you tried to sound too much like somebody else, if you were successful enough not to get booed off the stage, then that other person that you were trying to sound like would step to you. And then y'all would battle, and if they didn't feel like you won, then you had to battle with the hands. It was crazy, but it was real. Mm-hmm. It kept everybody in a place. You know what I'm saying? Like, nah, man, let me be original. You know what I'm saying? And so I think what switched it up a lot or more or less affected it from a creative standpoint was the lack of, from the business side, you know, you got to understand, when the different labels or whatever, you know, they were looking for what's hot. It still are, but they were really looking more or less for what was hot and saying, well, if that works, then somebody, the next artist that comes through the door has to sound like them because that's the money maker. So they were literally kind of stripping new artists that didn't, you know, just to put them into a protocol. Like, nah. You got to sound like this. Because we just won with these cats. So how close to these cats can you sound? You understand? Instead of, like, in the beginning, it was a smorgasbord. You know, Kane didn't sound like Biz. Biz didn't sound like Kool G Rap. You know what I'm saying? De La Soul didn't sound like Doug and Slick. You know, everybody, the Fat Boys didn't sound like the Treacherous Three. But there was more, since it was younger, there was more of an open mind towards it. So as long as you were being true to your own craft, it was respected. Different was respected. You know, and so for a long period of time, different and unique was not respected. So it seems like it's coming back to that now. So, you know, it is what it is.
Now, when we look at it from different aspect in terms of the originality, I wanted to ask this question from both of you and Hitman's perspective, because there is really during that era, you know, and he would really, really go on to, like, become one of the most respected in terms of abstract rhyme. And, of course, we can't leave out Kool Keith of Ultra Magnetic, a.k.a. Mm-hmm. Dr. Octagon. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't leave him out.
Nobody ever mentions him.
And of course, Hitman, what was it like in terms of those battles? Because, you know, like Smooth was saying, you know, there would always, you know, there was contention between composition and creativity. You know, there was a battling, but we never heard anything in that time about in New York where there was these, like, there was battling, but they had never got to a point of personal. How did you all manage to keep a professional from a creative level of artistry and not let it become acrimonious, abrasive, aggressive, and ultimately violent? Where was the line? How did y'all know how to draw that line?
Now, when we go first, well, move?
Go ahead.
All right, well, me on a battling tip, I'm going to keep it brief. It was more so, like, you got to just, I was just dissing them. You know I mean, I talk about your sneakers, talk about your hair. No, you talk about your mama over there getting high. That type of battling. That was my kind of battle. It wasn't really on the physical fighting battle. It was like basically who got the better jokes or who got the better diss
right
in the battle. That was my era, like, you know, and it got, you know, like who got the better words or your flow, who was louder, you know, more aggressive, and then who could get the people to go, oh, then you won the battle. You know, that's on my end.
Right.
Yeah, battling was more so fun. Like, it's like at the end of the day, y'all could go ahead and it was like battling back then. It was like, okay, everybody could smile and have fun and hug each other afterwards. It won't really in your face.
Right.
And they won't talk about chopping up your family.
Right.
And, you know what I'm saying? It wasn't nothing extreme like that.
Right, right. And like you said, to back then it was just more of an open mind of the craft and the skill. You know, skill was respected more. So even if you got into a battle, like with me, my wordplay was always bananas. So any battles that I found myself in, I knew that I would say certain things that either was going to make people laugh or scratch their head and say, yo, that nigga crazy. Yo, what made him put that word together like that? And so, you know, I knew, but I would sit down and just be like, I'm going to say something that's mind-boggling. You know what I'm saying? And then my opponent would just be like, look back at me and go, oh, yeah, that was crazy, nigga. That was crazy. Or, you know, or the people. You know what I'm saying? But it was never like that. You know what I'm saying? But, like, and it's funny, off the record, if it came to rapping, then that's what I would just use skill. But like, I used to snap a lot. So I would get more, believe it or not, I would get more fights for snapping on somebody than I would for battling somebody in a rap, a rap contest. Because, you know, if you started me up, my snaps was bananas. And once I get into my bag, I just keep going and going and going. And then when the person be like, all right, yo, chill, man, all right, Smooth. I be like, oh, no, nigga, you done started me now. And I just keep going, and next thing you know, we fighting. But, yeah,
roast.
Yeah, that's how I used to be. Yeah, oh, boy. Oh, my God, son. Yeah, because I would get creative with it. You know, I just use my imagination and start saying crazy shit. So I don't know. But that was
now,
it. That was
roasted,
a part of
man.
Going up, man.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's always been a part of the game because it was always about being able to be quick with the words and the wit because it was like letting people know that, you know, because a lot of times when you're looking at rhyming, it's one thing, but when you have the intrinsic element of, you know, rhyme superiority, there's always going to, you know, inevitably be, you know, you're going to let a dude know, like, this is why you slacking, this is why I'm rapping, this is why I'm with it, and this is why you just shit with it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, it's a lot. Now, in the 1990s era, because we're seeing a change, you know, gangster rap is becoming really big, of course. Ice Cube has left NWA at the time and has dropped America's Most Wanted, which was like just a detonation on dope. Simultaneously, we also see somewhat of a slow commercialization of hip-hop coming, of course. Please Hammer Don't Hurt Him and Vanilla Ice is To the Extreme, both released in 1990. Both were the first two albums to reach diamond in terms of 10 million copies sold during that period. When you all are looking at this, you know, Smooth, you're already in the industry, Hitman, you're making your name, just tearing it up on the scene. What did you all feel like the culture was headed in terms of when those albums became big, in terms of how the marketing was? Because this is the time we start seeing more of the mainstream get involved with it, where hip-hop is not, the rap music is not so much an underground phenomenon anymore that's only for a chosen few, but it's actually becoming national. What did you all feel from it spreading at that capacity, and who at the time was the most popular with it?
Oh, man. Let me add on with that one. You know, it was so
go ahead.
You know, by that time, you got to understand, I came straight from, like, the hood with it, from the streets of New York, and then I got a chance to write for Bobby Brown. So I started writing for Bobby, that was my professional entrance into the music industry. So
is this an
the
exclusive?
Rap that you
Does anybody
Bobby
know about
said,
that stuff,
Doug? No. People know. Yeah, people know.
Okay,
It's a known fact. Actually, I'll give you one. When he went solo and he left New Edition, his first single was called Girlfriend, and that was on the King of Stage album. Now, if you watch the Girlfriend video, you'll see me in that video. Yeah, and that was in 1986. You see a 90-pound Smooth B walking next to Bobby with a rope chain on. Yeah. So, and you know, So he introduced me to the game from that perspective and started bringing me through record companies. I used to go with him to MCA. Then I traveled the country with him. Then I started singing background for him and all of that, man. Brought me to California for the first time and all that. You know, I had my groupie love with Bobby first, you dig? So it was all a preparation for, you know, my own success with Nice and Smooth and so forth and so on. But the thing was, you know, by that time, like, by the time he came out with Don't Be Cruel skyrocketed, and he ended up selling, like, 16 million worldwide. But the thing was, and the funny part about it, people don't really realize it, what they call the Hammer Pants was first the Bobby Brown Pants. That's another story. So, but that was the inspiration. Like Hammer, you know, Hammer damn near had a Gumby haircut. You dig what I'm saying? Those were all those different inspirations. But so the thing was, and Bobby was like kind of like he was my introduction, but I used to sprinkle him with different ideas. Like the Gumby haircut was my idea. You know what I'm saying? And he just happened to, he loved hip hop. Bobby is a B-boy. So he loved hip hop. And, you know, but singing and rapping back then wasn't, they didn't want that. The industry didn't want to mix the genres. So once Bobby became so successful with mixing, because he stood his ground. I remember MCA was like, what are you rapping for? You're not a rapper. And they would be upset. And he was like, look, man, I'm fucking with this. You know what I'm saying? So long story short, he was the litmus. And once he blew up, I said, oh, man, I could do this. You know what I'm saying? I could do this because I was so close to it. So all that to say, I was used to seeing things like that. I was getting the opportunity as far as, like, seeing huge success. But also with success having a sprinkle of hip-hop. So the thing was, by the time Hammer came, I just was like, yeah. Because my mind was, Now the bag is there. Now we get to the bag. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And so I didn't trip on Hammer. Yeah, I was happy for him. I was like, yeah, sell him back a sticker. Because if they calling you a rapper, we going to eat. You know what I'm saying? I love this shit. We about to eat. When that nigga Hammer started buying horses and shit, I was so happy for his ass. I never met him. I said, oh, my God. I got to get to the bag. You know what I'm saying? Everybody mad at him and shit. I said, what? And then I fucked around and came to L.A., and I actually met him in Roscoe's Chicken and Waffles on Gower.
Shout out to Roscoe's.
And when I met him, shout out to Roscoe's. And when I actually met him, I walked in there, and he was sitting in the damn restaurant. I used to see everybody in that restaurant, Tupac, everybody. So when I walked in there and I see him, I said, oh, fuck yeah, I got to go over there and give him a pound. Now, this is by the time he had that shit, can't touch this. Woo!
Yeah.
So he was out of here. So I damn near walked up to the nigga and said, boom, doo, doo, doo. I just walked up to the motherfucker. I was like, what's up? I said, Smooth B, right? And, you know, and he was like, oh! He said, man, I know who you are. And he gave me a pound, hugged me and shit. But he was real. You understand what I'm saying? And real recognized real. So I said, oh, no, this is a stand-up dude right here. You know, he didn't get on no bullshit. He ain't act fake. He just was like, yeah, man. And we just started kicking it. And so when I actually came back to New York and I would hear people bring him up or talk crazy, I'd be like, nah, he a real dude, B. He a real dude, you know. But you know, I never, his success, it never tripped me out. I was just like, come on, man. Who giving out that money? I got to be where that nigga at. Where his bag coming from? You know what I'm saying? I wanted to catch some of that bag. And
did
you know, and I wanted to do it my way.
Popeye's chicken?
Man, look, I don't knock nobody hustle. You know what I'm saying? I don't knock nobody hustle. You know what I'm saying? It's like, if you successful at it, get it, bro. Because at the end of the day, all we trying to do is feed our families. You dig? So, and you never know what another person's background is or what they've been through. You know, if you haven't walked in their shoes, you know what I'm saying? And then it's later when you see behind the music and you see that these cats that came from the hood, just another hood, you know? But, yeah, man. But the industry try to pit us together, like pit us against each other, you know? Oh, yeah, well, it just was weird. It just was some weird shit that was going on. I was like, look, man, you know, it's just weird, like, crack that bag open. That was my thing. In the 90s, I was like, where the bag go? Like, but where the bag? You know, I'm not going to compromise, but where's that? I'm going to stay on my square, but where's that? So, yeah, but that's how it was, man. Yeah.
It, man.
So
I mean,
ahead.
Wow. Because we gotta get, we're gonna get back to you in a sex move because you got a lot, because there's a lot of stuff we gotta address that we haven't got to yet. Hitman, in terms of it, tell us about, you know, when you really started moving, was a record deal something that you were pursuing at the time when you were starting out, or was it you were just pretty much doing it for fun, you know, and just seeing what would come from it?
Well, I was down that sleeping bag trying to fuck with Smooth, and I ain't even know Smooth yet, but I was outside waiting for him to come out. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, so I could ride with him, but I couldn't catch him. But I was definitely trying to get a deal. I had an independent deal with this label called AV8 Records. They had Fat Man Smooth on there. And it just didn't fly because I didn't know the business. I was just trying to, you know, I was more so into the studio making records and trying to make the hottest record and keep up to the Bronx status. And when
right.
hip-hop, when Hammer and them came out, I knew it was money. I said, damn, I got to get in this shit. They, you know, they got Ferraris and mansions, and they got waterfalls down this fucking mountain, and I'm in the project. Like, damn. You know what I'm saying? And NWA came out, and they was getting bags saying, fuck the police. I said, oh, shit, I could say that? So it's like, yeah, I definitely was trying to get a record deal. I definitely want to end the game because I seen that you can make money, and it turned into a job for me. Like, this is my job now. I don't have to work in a supermarket no more. I don't have to just be on that corner. I could write a record and get paid and then perform and get paid as well. So I look at it like a job, man. You know, it was occupation. I made it my lifetime thing.
What is the business? Yeah. What was the elements like for artists getting signed back in the day in terms of the business? Because we look at situations, of course, with EPMD, where they were on Def Jam, they were pretty much self-contained because they rapped and produced, so they didn't necessarily need the label's money outside of just the means of distribution. What was the label's criteria for signing artists during that time that you were getting on a hit?
Me?
Yeah.
I was around Doug, so I was
Gotcha.
Wherever he went, I went. I mean, Doug got me signed to Motown one time, but it didn't go right because I came into Motown when he brought me down there, and he was making certain kind of music, and I didn't like that music. It was like the dude's name was I forgot his name, but he was one of them calling, like Young MC type of rapper, and I wasn't trying to make my shit like that. So I was signed to them for a little while. The dude Clark Kent gave me a contract. I got dropped because I couldn't produce the records they want me to produce. So I knew that when it comes to getting a deal, you had to do what the label said to do. When you come to some kind of deal, you gotta be a puppet, and I wasn't willing to be a puppet. So,
it's about playing the game.
During that time, because when we look at the history of Motown, because we saw a lot of artists. Because Motown was trying to kind of branch out periodically through the years. Because AZ, shout out to the, Brooklyn Zone Smooth Hustler, AZ, he was on Motown for a minute. And,
Miss Jones, I got the same deal. But,
okay,
she was an R&B singer coming off of Bill Stephanie. So it was hard to get me a deal because I was too hard. The group I was in was called The Hood, and we was out before Onyx, so we had the bald heads and the army suits and shit. We was in the Bronx doing it over there on Webster, by Webster Avenue, around the area, Tremont, Katona Park, shooting our videos over there with the bald heads and shit. And all of a sudden, we was about to put our shit out. Onyx came out, same look. I'm like, oh man. And I got a bald head by mistake because my man was trying to cut my head, trying to get a Gumby, and he zipped my shit. So I cut all my hair off, and so they felt, my niggas felt bad. It's a true story. So everybody cut their shit off, so I won't feel bad. Back in the days, we get a bald head, it looked funny, it was funny, you know what I mean? So,
right.
our image stopped us from getting signed to major labels. It was just too hard at the time.
Yeah.
It wasn't fresh.
And when you mentioned Miss Jones, because I remember a song she did, because, first she had the joint, Where I Want to Be, and then there was another joint she performed on Soul Train some years ago called Make You Love Again. I was waiting for that album to drop, and I was so mad when it didn't, because I was really feeling her, she's an esteemed radio personality now doing a thing, but Miss Jones, shout out to Miss Jones, man, she was, Smooth, you and Greg Nice dropped y'all debut in 1989 on May 16th, what was it like for y'all actually getting to, really get y'all music out there? Because this is, 2 years before, the game changer from y'all, and 3 years from when y'all would make the legendary appearance, and you know where I'm going with this. When y'all end up on Gangstar's album with DeWitt, take us through that 3-year period of those two albums and that legend, and that legendary appearance.
Hello? I think it's Call Got Dropped.
Okay, it's Call Got Dropped. Okay.
Sorry about that. No, I'm here. Listen, I know
okay.
the whole thing.
Okay,
I apologize.
Okay.
Give me a sec. Because I'm actually in a studio session as we speak, mixing a song. So I'm like, I'm kicking it with y'all, then I'm running in here listening like Airball Hustling. Okay, so now go ahead. Tell me, the question was about doing Wick. Go ahead. I'm multitasking, gentlemen.
So y'all first album comes out May 16, 1989, Nice and Smooth. This is 2 years before
you know, just the watershed, the game changer for y'all. Ain't a damn thing changed in 91. And then after 91, y'all just, I mean, one of the greatest guest appearances ever on a joint with Gangstar's DeWitt, you know, off of Daily Operation. I mean, take us through that three-year period in terms of what it was like with your debut, your sophomore effort, and then that. Because, I mean, you all just, I mean, that three-year run of history was just unbelievable. Take us through it.
Oh, man. Thank you, brother. So, basically, it was the initial, it was, what I call that is the ultimate roller coaster ride, to be truthfully honest with you, right? So we signed with Sleeping Bag, which was a great thing, right? I'll cut through it, and then I'll come back and we'll do some more, but I'll chop this up for you real quick. So we get the first deal with Sleeping Bag. Right? All right, fine. Now we're on Sleeping Bag. We signed to Sleeping Bag for basically like 2 years because we signed in like 88, but they didn't release the our album till 89. So it was like, it was so mind-blowing. It was nerve-wracking for us because, you know, back then it was like you want to do your music and you want it to come out when you do it. So if that first album was already done, it was complete in 88, but it didn't come out to 89. So it was bugging us out like, oh, man. And we didn't want anybody biting our style. It was crazy. So anyway, finally, it comes out in 89. And then by 1990, Sleeping Bag files for bankruptcy. So it was just like, what? You know what I'm saying? So the whole thing was, you know how they say the blessing and the curse. Well, the blessing was that in our particular contract, we had a bankruptcy clause. And the bankruptcy clause stipulated that if Sleeping Bag had ever gone bankrupt, that we would retain 100% of our publishing. Look how God works. So now, just as we go gold, that would have been, we were getting like a dollar, and that would have even been unheard of back then because nobody was getting like $1.50. You know what I'm saying? But that was in our contract. So I'm like, I'm a new father. You know what I'm saying? My daughter's born. I'm like, all right, I'm about to get this bag. And then Sleeping Bag goes out of business. So I'm like, what? So then long story short, they go out of business, but then I discovered that there's a bankruptcy clause. Boom. So now we retain 100% of our publishing. Then from that point, Def Jam, Russell Simmons buys EPMD and us and Nice and Smooth out of the Sleeping Bag contract. The deep part about it was he was already planning on getting, because he was managing EPMD, so he was planning on getting them. That was like a no-brainer. They went out of business, I bring y'all to Def Jam. And then he was right, as told by Russell to me, he said, yeah, man, the way I heard about y'all was I was riding around in the car with Joey with Run, and Run was playing our first album. And he was like, what you listening to? He's like, it's these kids, these new niggas from the Bronx, they dope. And then one thing led to another. And so he was like, what label they on? He was like, Sleeping Bag. He was like, all right, I'm going to get them too. Fine. So they brought aside that contract, and we go to Def Jam. So now we get on Def Jam, and then we had, you know, we were already longstanding friends with Guru and Premier. You know, that was our boys. And so they came and jumped on the song called Down the Line with us, and that was on the Ain't a Damn Thing Changed album. And so after we did that song together, we always kept saying, we're going to do another one together. We're going to do another one together. And, you know, for y'all album, we did this one for our album. We're going to do one for y'all album. And then of course that ended up being Dwick. Boy, oh man, boy, oh boy. You know what I'm saying? But go ahead.
But I mean, but when y'all dropped Ain't a Damn Thing Changed, I mean, when y'all dropped Hip Hop Junkies, I mean, what was it like when that song hit? And I mean, did y'all know it was gonna be as big as it was?
Yeah, you know, the deep part about it was through the first album we got a chance to recognize and realize what people liked from us. You know what I'm saying? They liked the way we were. They liked that we had the anime, you know, the animation to us. They liked the contrast in our styles and all of that. So we was like, okay, bet. And so, funny thing about, oh man, I tell you a fun fact. So I'm at the time I'm living in New Jersey, right? I got a little crib in Jersey, a little condo, and I used to take the PATH train home from the city. So one day I get off at General Square, and when you came out the train station, there was a Sam Goody across the street. So one day I go in to Sam Goody, and I just, you know, me and Greg, man, we always be collecting cassettes and all that. And just, you know, we was always just always thinking about where we're going to get a new idea from, what kind of beats we're going to flip and all that. So I go in there, and they had a 99-cent bin. So I started digging through the bin, and I found a cassette, and it said songs from the 60s, that type of thing. It was a cassette, songs from the 60s. So I snatched that and a couple other cassettes. I go back to the crib. I'm chilling. And my queen, you know, she was there, you know, making some spaghetti and shit. And I put the tape in the radio, and a 60s song came on, and then the next song came on was the Partridge Family. I think,
yeah.
I Love You. And it was...
Yeah, I think I love you. So what am I so afraid of? Yeah.
Exactly, you dig. And so I was like, all right, bet. I said, that shit sound crazy. I said, I wonder. I said, I got to see if G could fuck with that. So next door to me was my man. His name was Horace Hampton. He was my next door neighbor, and he was also our bass player. And he and he had pre-production. We had set up pre-production in his crib. So it was crazy. I get to the crib, and then about 2 hours later, Greg came through. So he knocked on the door. He was like, what's up, baby? I was like, chilling. He's like, I'm going to be next door fucking around with Horace. I said, all right. I said, yo, listen. Check out, listen to this song. So I gave it to him. And so he went on. We went next door, and he started listening to it. And then about an hour later, he just came banging on the door. He done fucked around, and he looped up that intro, put the drums under it. Yo, that shit was crazy. And when I came over there, I was like, oh, that shit crazy. So he said, yo, let's play with that shit. He said, you know, we got funky for you. He said, let's stay in that funky zone. You know, say some shit like, I got a funky rhyme. Like I say, I got a funky rhyme, and then you say, you got a funky rhyme. And I was like, all right, bet. Oh my God! And then I just kept listening to it, and my ass. I started. I got a funky mind with a funky style. I got a funky. Oh man, dude! When I tell you, we tore into that motherfucker. Obviously, you dig. But that's how it was born. That's how that song was born. So for 99 cents, we we did some shit. We made a hit for 99 cents.
Man.
You know,
that's real right there. That's real inspiration,
yeah,
right there. Talk
yeah,
about it.
You know what I'm saying?
Talk about it.
Yeah, man. And so, yeah, man. And so we kept going, and then of course, Gangsta. Like I said, that was our boys. They were originally on Wild Pitch, and then they got picked up by Chrysalis, and it was funny, like. They got picked up by Chrysalis, and then they kept telling us, no, you're going to get picked up, though. We all going to get picked up. And next thing, we got picked up by Def Jam. And we was like, yeah, we got to do a joint. So I remember when we first did Rick, we brought it to Def Jam for them to hear it. No, actually, we told them. That's how it started. We was like, yeah, we're going to do a record with Gangsta. And, you know, Leon was funny back then, man. They kept everything from their own perspective. But if you remember, a lot of people wasn't doing collabs back then. So they wanted, you know, monetarily, they wanted to keep everything where it was. So they were like, why you want to do a record with somebody else? Why you want to do a record with other artists on their labels? And I'm like, nigga, so we could expand our fan base. What the fuck is wrong with y'all? So, you know, they just, they didn't get it. And so we was like, look, we could put it on both our albums. And they was like, no. So they really didn't want us to do it. They didn't hear it. You know, we hadn't done it yet, just a mere idea. So they told us they didn't want us to do it, and, you know, we went and did it anyway. We went and did it. You know what I'm saying? And shit, the rest, as they say, was history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And coming through that era, Hitman, after you see them blowing, and you're seeing, of course, 91, because this is a very monumental year as well, because, you know, we're seeing DJ Quick drop his debut that year. Of course, we're seeing Tupac drop Tupacalypse Now that year. I mean, of course, NWA drops Niggas for – yeah, Death Certificate, NWA drops Niggas for Life. 91 was a hell of a year for hip-hop music, man.
That was the best. One of the best years, too. I think from 80 for me, because I'm young.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a little younger.
Mm-hmm.
I think from what I know, like I used to watch Hot Tracks and all that other shit, and I used to watch Hot Tracks back in the days, and from like 85 – on to 97 was the best years for me. When Nice and Smooth came out, that was one of the best years, because the parties was on point, the shows was on point, and then it taught me what I learned from Smooth and them is how to make a record. I never knew how to make a record until I heard that first album. I studied that album so hard, man. I said, yo, we got to make records like Smooth being them. And I was just, you know, I couldn't sing, but I wanted to. But they showed me how to put a record together, man. A record that makes sense, that will last. And it took me years, even after I studied Smooth B and studied Nice and Smooth, it still took me more years to even get it. Because, you know, the way they did it, with nobody could recreate that. So, you know, that's my big up to my big homie Smooth, like, made a mastermind when it comes to putting them records together. I'm telling you that. So I learned from that. Then I learned from Doug, you know, both of them together. But Smooth and them was more different than Doug. Doug was just mostly the bebops and the bebops and that. They was on the rapping tip. So I put both of that together, and that's how I created me. You see what I'm saying?
I want to add on to you. Go ahead. What was you going to say?
Go ahead, please.
No, I wanted to shout out Doug, too, because I had some great memories with Doug, too, you know what I'm saying, going back, man. Doug is brilliant. That's a brilliant dude right there, man. But, it's crazy. Yeah.
You don't hear nothing. Nobody say nothing negative about Dougie Fresh at all. Not one bad story.
Right. Yeah, now he's a good dude, man. But, it's crazy in this game. It's even crazier.
Well, you know, it's funny, too, because when we talk about the history, because we talked about Hammer earlier, you know, because this also is about 6 degrees of separation, because Doug would end up signing to Hammer's label, Busted Records, at the time for a second. What was that like in terms of the transition? Because both of you knew Doug personally. What was it like in terms of that transition for him, in terms of, you know, moving, you know, along at that particular point?
I mean, you know, I don't know what his experiences were, his endeavors, but I do know Doug probably wanted, I mean, I know Doug wanted that bag.
That's what it was about. he wanted that bag, and, you know, he felt like, I ain't going front, I was there around that time. I was definitely part of that situation. And I think that he was looking at it where Hammer was the entertainer. He was doing the same dance, song and dance like he was. And he was always, he also was looking at it on a standpoint where I'm trying to bridge the East and the West, showing that it's cool to be over there and do this shit. But it was the wrong timing. It was the wrong timing, man.
Right.
Wrong timing. You know what I mean? So I think that he was trying to do something great, but New York wasn't hearing it. And that, you know. That's how it was. They won't hear that shit. Like, fuck you, Doug. You fucked up.
Yeah. And you all are, in terms of you all's creativity being in such an immaculate and infinite place, when you look at a lot of artists over the years, in terms of noted freestylers like Papoose, Supernatural, Cannabis, they've always been lauded. Huh? Go ahead.
No, I'm saying, when you say Supernatural, I ain't heard that name in a long time.
Yeah, you know, of course, they had a joint back called Buddha Blessed. You know, they had a joint called Buddha Blessed.
I ain't heard him in
a
minute.
L.O.G. and the Bulldogs. That's, you know them niggas? L.O.G. and the Bulldogs.
Going back to the Blaze battle with that one.
Come on. Going back to the
Blaze battle with that one.
Stephasonic.
on that jazz.
Yeah, but when you look at a lot of those guys who would know the freestyle legends, like, you know, like I said, Pap and all of them, they were lauded for their lyrical abilities, but a lot of people always, you know, noted that they always had difficulty being able to transition that word talent into writing songs. From both of you's perspectives, Smooth and Hitman, what are the elements for an artist in terms of streamlining their ability to articulate that into a hit song in terms of understanding the nuance, the melody, the flow, ultimately the hook that catches the audience?
You know, I mean, I would say the bottom line is you gotta stay true to you. You know, it's funny. I think that everybody is created from in a unique space. It's
right.
Just that people got to realize how unique everyone is created. And once you can value your uniqueness, then you can begin to make it take it to another level. You dig what I'm saying? It's like, it's crazy. Nobody can do what you can do if you do it the way you're supposed to do it.
Mm.
That's it. Because we all created that kind of way. We all created on a certain frequency. You dig? Yo, listen, guys, I can't even front. I got to get back in this session, man.
Okay. It's all
I'm loving
it's all
the
good.
Bill with y'all. I just didn't want to break it. I committed. I said, look, I'm doing this interview. And I fucking forgot I had this session. But I got to get back in there.
It's all good. It's all good.
Hey, man, you got to keep guys.
We're going to have you on the show, future show. Yeah.
Yeah, putting the classics back
no,
out,
stop,
brother.
Get that work done, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm gonna put that work in, man. I love y'all more than cook food, man. But we gonna build, cause I don't want to take from either one. I want to sit down and really go extensively with you guys, man. But it's a pleasure,
definitely.
And I thank you again. You know what I'm saying? And thank you for having my brother right there with y'all, man.
Yeah, we appreciate you coming in. Definitely.
Absolutely. We gonna build further. And look, this next interview, when y'all hear this damn song that I'm doing, I'm like, this is what I was doing when I was doing the interview. That's a deal. That's a deal.
Yeah.
All right.
Hey, man, hold it down,
all right,
bro.
All right, I will,
definitely,
man. Much love,
you.
Y'all.
Yeah.
Love forever.
Much love, man. Thank you again.
Of course, man. You got it. All right. Let's stay in touch. All right.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I'm moved out.
Okay. I bet. 100, y'all.
Definitely. So, I mean, here, we get to hear your perspective from it. Because some artists have that issue transitioning in terms of it, and it's hard for them. You know, what is your creative process in terms of when you write? And what is your opinion of how you've seen the game change over the years from when you started to the present day, today?
Well, when I write, I like to, first of all, I write in the bathroom. I don't care what bathroom it is. I'm going in the bathroom with four walls and it's real tight, so I can actually think and no distraction. I think when you're writing sometimes you got to expand your mind and you have to think about other stuff that people won't normally say. You know, the conversation has to be relevant. It has to be detailed. Has to be to the point. You can't just, you know, you hear some rap stories and it's like, oh, when are we going to get to the point of the story? Go right into it. I feel like when you're using your pen has to actually drag whatever, exactly what's in your thought pattern, in your mind, in your membrane, whatever you're thinking in your membrane, try to get it as close as possible to that paper. That's what's going to make you a brilliant writer, like, you know, the painters. The mirror, it looked exactly like that person because they dug in their mind so far in their brain where when you see the mirror on the wall of a person that passed or a person that's still here, it looked just like that person. That's how it is with a pen. You got to get deep with it. And now you don't have to get all real, like, big words. Just be simple, but just be so deep where I can close my eyes and I can see it. That's what I made Shake That Ass to the Floor. I made that record because I wanted the women to actually feel good about their bodies. Basically, it might sound funny, but if you know some women got big booties and
They clapping. So, okay, we can't stop y'all from doing that because that's y'all shit. Y'all eating off that right now. Okay, let me see you. Let me see you clap that ass to the floor. Squat, and I want to see your ass clap the floor. You know, every chick in the world gonna try to do it. This is I did it, but in all reality, it might not ever happen. You understand? If you can see a chick squat, you know how you squat like a back catcher,
mm-hmm.
and see her ass clapping the floor. That won't happen right now, but some chicks will think they could do it. So now I'm gonna start an epidemic, a pandemic. I'm gonna start a damn. It's gonna be some shit going around the whole world where every woman in the world is gonna try to clap their ass to the floor just to say they did it. And that's why I made the record, because it's gonna take off. It might not take off right now, but it's gonna take off in a few. Once you get around, you know. And that was clever. I kept it one verse.
You know.
Nice little chant hook, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Definitely. One thing about it, man, is when we look at hip-hop, because not only it's a street culture in terms of where the music was birthed, but hip-hop has always been about having fun. I mean, we think about mm-hmm. some of the songs that just, I mean, we have songs like 2 Live Crew's Pop That Coochie, you know, we have Sir Mix-a-Lot's mm-hmm. Baby Got That, you know, when
mm-hmm.
we got Juvenile Bad Ass Up. Yeah, Tupac,
yep.
I get around.
And of course,
one of the most classic, you know, announcements coming in, Cash Money taking over for the 99 and 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it just
mm-hmm.
how important is it in terms of?
Hey, can I throw y'all a bone right quick? Can I throw y'all a
sure.
bone right quick?
Go ahead,
yeah.
King, what is it?
I got to bring up this one, man. This is the all time great right here. Trip.
Go ahead.
The tip drill.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
look,
that's right.
Nelly's Saint Lunatics. We can't leave them out of it. You know, I mean, when
that's
it comes
right.
to party tracks, Nelly came. They came with a classic with that one. And I want to ask you this too, Hit, because when we look at how you said you wanted women to feel positive about their bodies,
right.
King and myself and you came up in a time where we didn't have the liposuction, we didn't have the silicone, we didn't have the BBC, the BBL,
mm-hmm.
Brazilian butt lift. Our women really embrace their natural beauty. Us is, you know, men that love women, we just love the naturalness that our queens had. And now it's like
right.
all these, you know, and it's changed now. It's like women are trying to go by these false standards of beauty, and it's like, you know, they're thinking that their natural curves or whatever aren't good enough for what us men like. And I'd be trying to tell them, like, no, boo, we love it. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Was that a conscious decision you made when you decided to make that song in terms of really celebrating the authenticity, the just the variety, the vivaciousness, the gorgeousness, and celebrating, you know, all shades of beautiful blackness with our queens?
Yes, it was. It was definitely that. You hit it on the nail. I feel like that it would definitely bring women together, because this is something that a selective few of women got to do. Like, if you go to a club, you got chicks in the club, they dancing around, but we're not. I witnessed it. When the record comes on, they hear that doo 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 doo. It's like, okay, we got to run to the floor now. They run into the floor. So when that beat drops, they want to see. They looking around at each other to see which one could do it the best. So now it's a competition, but it's a friendly competition. After the song is over and they all just shook their ass to the floor, they could talk about it. Girl, you were shaking to the floor. Girl, oh, you look the good girl. What's your name? What's your number? Let me follow you. Now I'm bringing people together. You see what I'm saying? It's like I'm using my mind to bring back the organization of parties. When you went to a party, it was an organization. Everybody
yes.
had to do something.
Yes.
Cool lady.
Yes.
At the door. That's right. So I'm bringing that unity back through an ass shaking. You see? I figured out that if you can't stop certain violence, you can't stop certain arguments from happening, but you can always get somebody's eye looking at that ass. It's fat right there. You're going to look. You're a man. You're going to look, right? So now the men is in the club dancing on the ass. The women is competing. Now everybody's doing what? Having fun. You see how I did it? I'm trying to bring fun back into the game because fun left the game and guns came to kill everybody. So now, if you're killing anybody, we ain't going to have nobody to rap on stage no more because you didn't kill every fucking body. So now, I'm trying to save the industry with bringing that fun rap. I could come out with some hardcore shit and just turn everybody out like, yo, I'm going to kill shit. But why do that when I want to make a change? We had enough of that killing shit, man. For years, they've been dying. Since Tupac, the killing didn't stop. You know what I mean? So it's time for a change for hip-hop. So the ass to the floor will be, I'm going to spark the flame for the next person to make it bigger than what I did. But I have to spark that flame so they can say, what's that over there? Let me go do a record like that, but better. I don't care. Long as you keep the same vibe going, because now we're bringing peace back to the industry through an ass cheek. I just looked at something that could catch people's eyes and take their mind off of killing somebody. You know what I'm saying?
Where do you think it all changed? Because of course, where do you think it all changed? Because we always had the street element in it, but it was actually telling the real story. If you heard songs like, you know, Spice One's "Trigger Got No Heart," or you know what I'm saying, Kool G Rap's, you know, "Ill Street Blues." You know, these were hardcore songs, but they also were telling a story. Where do you think the game started changing for the worse, where the violence became mindless in the songs, and it was not telling a story, but it was kind of like an overindulgence of the worst elements? I don't want to say glorifying King. It just kind of became, well, yeah, you could say glorifying too, but it was glorifying the most savage elements of the human animal, of us being animals. Where do you think it started changing?
It started changing when people started actually living it. Like, you know, we telling a story about, like you said, L Street Blues and Road to the Riches, them were stories that we could listen to. But then now,
right,
as generations went on, these young guys started actually doing it. It was actually being done on record and off record. So now, for me being a hip hop artist and I'm talking mad trash on my record, when you see me, you step to me and be like, yo, what's up with that shit you was saying? And you're gonna pull a gun out and you're gonna kill me. It became a fashion for it. It became a fashion for social media to be in jail or catch a body or smack abroad or you holding guns and money. So now it became a way of them saying, okay, I'm this hard, I'm really hard. You know, it ain't a story. This is what I'm really doing. So some of these dudes had mommy and daddy in the house. They grew up in a good neighborhood. They never seen the bricks or they never had roaches or rats. They never been hungry. They grew up good. So now the way they got to do it is they got to really be this way for people to believe them. So now that's where the killing comes. So that it changed around the time 50 Cent came in. Because when 50 Cent came in, he was really like that. He was on some gangster shit. Ja Rule was too, but he was more so on the women tip because he was selling records. So at that time, the younger generation was pushing through. So they were trying to be harder than this generation. So they said, fuck that, we're going to really do this shit. And then the bodies start coming. So now you're seeing all these young rappers dying. I watched this thing on YouTube. It says 99 rappers that died in 2021. That's some shit. Like, all these guys died from gun violence because they talking that shit. Whatever you say, you're talking into an existence. You know, if you can say, yo, I'm going to get some money. All of a sudden, you're getting some money. So everybody talking about they got Glock 9 and shites. I'm going to your crib. I'm going to kill you. Fuck you. And they saying now, they saying niggas' names on record. They ain't even saying subliminals. They saying, yo, this dude over there, fuck you. Yo, your elbow, fuck you. Elbow, I'm going to kill you on a record. So now you're bringing that street shit to record, and then the record is bringing the street shit to the street. So it's like ping-ponging. It can't stop. So that's how it happened.
Then not to mention, too, see, another aspect of this thing, too, is that these guys are getting rewarded. Because they're getting rewarded without really giving the balance of what to come with the behavior. Because seen guys like Pac and Biggie getting killed, everybody took a fall back. They were like, yo, this is really real right here. We got to watch what we say a little more. So it's just like you said, after 50 Cent, and he survived, and he built an empire off of beef. So now everybody else is looking at it like, damn, this nigga did it, so I'm going to try it like them.
right. And that's how it was, man. Yeah. You know, these young dudes, they just took it to another level. And, you know, and no disrespect, I'm not talking about no labels or anything like that, but some of these record labels know better because they allow these young artists to self-destruct because, you know, you're worth more money dead than alive. We all know that. And all this is for social media hype, social media publicity. Social media made money off of us killing each other. When Facebook and Instagram first came out, they wasn't as popular as they are now. They popular now because when you go on Instagram, what do you see? You see girls butt-ass naked clapping themselves, clapping their asses. You see dudes talking shit. You see somebody jumping out the window. And it's all basically black. See, so that's how they make their money. Now, you know?
Where do you think this whole now, and King and myself, my brother, we've always talked about this on the air and off the air with our guests, with each other about it in terms of the fascination with fame and how people at times are so driven by it. I don't know if you watch American Horror Story, shameless plug for that television show because I absolutely love it. This past season in the first part of the double feature of it, the plot, the overarching plot of this season with that show and the first half of it was about the black pill and fame and what people will do to get it and how far they will go to get it, who they will sacrifice to get it. What do you think it is about it today? Do you think it's because of social media, because it is so microwaved in terms of instant exposure, that now everybody is doing whatever they can to become this overnight celebrity, but they don't care the cost of it in terms of the imminent crash that will come from the recklessness of their exposure?
Yes, it's exactly that. Yes, social media is responsible for all of this, and social media knows that they're responsible for it, but they're making so much money, you know, from it. See, when people log on to social media accounts and they say it's free, it's actually not free. The more you stay on, the more money they make. Now, now we're talking about data. And it's similar to what you just said. The more craziness they have on social media, the more people are going to watch social media. That shit took over. That shit just knocked TV out, knocked radio out. Everybody got, I mean, people sleep with Facebook on. I mean, I was in my man crib, and he had his Facebook page open. Now he was sleeping. He had, dang, he wake up. Who's that? I'm like, damn, nigga. You know, it's like everybody's on drugs, but you're on a social media drug. Like, you got to be on this media every day. You got to, if you put a post up, you get like 5 likes, you mad. Oh, fuck, motherfuckers, you ain't got to support my shit over a like. So now you get mad over a like, and you get mad over a view, you get mad over, you know what I'm saying? Niggas ain't saying your shit. Like, yo, you know, you read the comments, yo, fuck everybody, I don't want to help you share my shit, that's my word. I mean, listen, they know what they're doing. They're making so much money off of our mental. They're destroying our mind because if you took social media away, if they took social media away tomorrow, what is everybody going to do? Nothing. They're going to be stuck.
You know, and I don't mean to take a shot at him when I say this, you know, because we got so much respect for him, but it's like with Boosie, what he said online, you know, it's like Boosie was heavy in his feelings because he feels like it's not, you know, heads aren't supporting his movie. And I was like, Boosie, I'm like, the people that are going to support it are going to support it regardless. But, you know, for you to get out there and kind of get mad at everybody because you feel like they're not doing what you think they should be doing supporting you, I'm like, I was just thinking that's very un-Boosie-like because Boosie is always going to do who's going to do his thing. But I'm like, how are you going to make a Dr. King comparison about, you know, what you're doing? And I'm just saying this as a journalist. I'm not saying this from a...
That bag getting short, man. So, you know, they get, it makes them feel sort of way. So now they going overboard when it comes to them not getting the promo they want.
That's right. They're not getting the promo. People ain't talking about them heavy on just like on sorts like 6ix9ine. He was on YouTube every single day. Now he ain't nowhere. So it's like people are, you know, he might be falling into that lane where people was directing their eyes and energy on another artist. So, you know, get mad and say, fuck y'all motherfuckers, blah, blah, blah. And that's why social media is the devil. It's the devil's playground. It's the Baphomet. It's the omega of the demon. It's number of demons up there. You know, people who put their businesses on social media, they put their life on it. They got their kids on there. You see the babies in the bed, and they put the babies, they got the babies in the carriage, laying there asleep. They got the cameras on the babies, trying to get a like and a view off a baby in a bed. When social media allowed them two white guys to cut that, to hang that black girl, you seen that one?
No, I think I missed that one.
It was on Facebook, and they had two white guys. And they had a 16-year-old black girl in the basement, and they had a rope around her neck, and they was pulling the rope, and they was hanging her. And that shit was on Facebook for like 2 months. When they allowed that to go on Facebook and they didn't flag it, that's how I knew that social media was devil's playground. When social media allowed showing people getting shot on Facebook Live and dying on Facebook Live, that should tell you something. I mean, I could look on YouTube and type in people, you know? That's like that.
You know, And one thing about it, when we look at it, because, you know, as far as we've been doing this show, King and myself, we have always tried to be responsible journalists, not only doing this show, but also what we put out there, you know. Mm-hmm. We put out, you know, my brother is just a consummate comedian, will crack us up with stuff he posts, but he has never posted anything derogatory, disrespectful, mm-hmm. or anything, and I'm always careful on my IG and Facebook to always just, we've seen enough ignorance out there. King is going to put comedy in because we all need to laugh, and I'm going to put out something thought-provoking on my pages because this is just what we do. We want to bring some level of mm-hmm. comedy and consciousness to the internet community.
You don't want to come sound too sinister.
Right. But you got some people, and then we also use it to promote this show, which we're so thankful for in terms of the supporters we have. But we have never, mm-hmm. ever, nor will we ever get into a place of such negative energy that we want to express the very worst of our character online. We have always, mm-hmm. certain things happen we don't like, but we don't need to get out there and just get to be those angry people. Like, you know, it's crazy, Hitman, because when you talk about the devil, you know, it's wild because you got some people that just got this evil energy that they just got to be critical of every fucking thing out there. And I'm
everything.
Like, God damn. I'm like, don't you have any happiness in your life? I'm like, ain't there anything y'all happy as hell? I'm like, all y'all, it's like some people just get online just to be nasty. And I'm like, why?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You know?
And that's because social media, so that's the devil's lair. And you know one more thing about that, why people do that?
Mm-hmm.
Social media is about attention. Who's getting the most attention, who's getting the most views and likes.
Yeah.
And it's a popularity mm-hmm. chase. So when you feel like you worked all day on this, like you work all day on this project, oh, my God, it's so fucking hot. Oh, my God, you're hyped up. And you put it out and you get 10 views and no likes. You're like, man, what? Then there you go. And that's, you know, I feel like, you know, that's when they say, okay, why don't you buy some social media boost? Now buy this, pay $20 and we'll boost your page. Now that becomes a money thing. Like I said, it's a corporation. It turned into a business where you got to buy their promotional tools to get your shit further, but you will never get no, I mean, artists on social media, out of 1,000 artists, maybe 2 going to make it. And there's no disrespect to your artists. I love all of y'all. I love your artists. I'm down for y'all. I support y'all to the maximum strength. But out of 1,000 artists on social media, 2 will make it. 1 will fly. 1 will be an overnight success and then die right away. Because nobody wants to listen and nobody wants to do the math and do the knowledge and use your brain. You know, it's about being smart and thinking of ways to just go all, you know, use social media for what it's worth, but don't live on it. You can't live on it. That's why I'm in the streets and I'm on the road. I pay for my own tour. My record label ain't got to pay for nothing because I don't want to owe y'all. I'm going to spend this money I got. If I'm broke, I'm just broke. But I'm going to hit the road so my fans can see me. That's why they love me in certain places. Some people might hate me because they feel like, how you do it and I can't do it. Just ask me and I'll tell you how I did it. You see what I'm saying? So that's what social media plays a big part in that. They see me traveling all over the place. and they get mad like, yo, fuck this nigga. He think he better than somebody. I don't think I'm better than nobody. I didn't spend my rent money to go to Oklahoma to do 5 shows, and I ain't even getting paid for these shows. I'm doing it for free just so the fans could see me in concert. That's the type of dude
you
I
know,
am.
I could, like, we got to build. We got to build on this for a second, Hitman, because you hit on some tremendous points that, you know, King and myself, we've talked about over the years with this show in terms of, King, remember how that conversation we would always have about all these quote-unquote followers these people have on IG and everything don't always equate to real fans?
Right.
Always, you
man.
Know,
it's the biggest force out people, there.
That's right. I mean, you know, people, it's like sometimes these young guys, they buy all these followers so they can have 1 million followers. So when you see their page, they might buy a blue check costs $285, $300 to buy a blue check for your page. Now you got a blue check, 2 million followers. But, you know, on social media, like, oh, my God, he's popping. But when you go on the streets, nobody know who the hell you are. That's why it's not good to buy fake shit. And a lot of these guys with these buying these fake views for millions and millions of views on these on these platforms, streaming platforms, then when you go perform your record, the way you find out who's who, perform your record in Oklahoma and see who know you. If nobody know you in Oklahoma, then you don't have 1 million views. Because 1 million views is 1 million people that spread it around the world. And I learned that from an old school guy. His name is TV Mel. He said, listen, look at social media and look at the people in the street. When you go to a concert, if that guy got a blue check and he claims his record is that hot, when he performs somewhere and nobody know it, then that means he brought everything. He faked everything, because a lot of these guys out here are faking it till they make it. You know, I don't believe in faking it. I don't believe in catfishing, because it catches up with you. And you're gonna look real bad.
Especially he's like, damn, this nigga got 500K followers, and 60 people only came to his show.
Right. That's how I go.
You know, and once
I performed in California, right? And, you know, California, the clubs are just now opening back up. So, you know, I said, okay, you know, I got Manson Bates, my old ex name, had a big following, a real big fucker. It's detached to Doug. You know me as Doug Nephew. So when I come to the spot, you know it's going to be a show. Hey, Davis the Hitman is my name, the new name, right? So when I pulled up in the spot, a lot of dudes, like, you know, they knew who I was because, you know, my record's playing out there and I'm in the streets. The streets know who I am. So when I went in the club, it was like 25, 30 people, the most. I'm like, damn, what the fuck is this? But I said, okay, COVID. And, you know, a lot of dudes, they didn't have the COVID card to get in the club. Club had at least 25, 30 people in there, right? And it was a big spot. The promoter said, man, if you want to leave, you can. And I said, nah, I'm not going to leave. If it was one person here, I'm going to perform for that one person. He gave me a hug. He said, I don't believe you said this shit, nigga. You know, another artist would have left. Nah, man. The second club, we had about 25 people in there, 20 people in there. I still did the same thing. The third club, it was like 300 people in there. I said, oh, okay. See, that's how God works. I could have left and said, man, fuck this tour, I'm out. But I stayed there when it was a tiny-ass crowd, and I performed for them 25 people, and I hung out with them. You see what I'm saying? And that's what matters to a person in life, when you do something for them, even if it's a tiny crowd. Still stay there and give the best show, like if it's 1 million people. And that's what people love you for. And then when they go on your social media page, and then they, you know, I got my followers up like this. I had that page for a long time. My first page, I had a lot of followers, and it got hacked. So I reached out to all the people that was on my first page and said, yo, I got a new page. And I get around quick. The way I get followers is that I got a promotional team who stay on media just sharing my profile. And, like, you might have, like, 10 – I got 10 dudes that go to college, right? And they on their social media junkies, and they got like 5,000 followers on Facebook. They might have 10,000 followers on Instagram each. So now they each will take my profile and just run it straight through everybody's tunnel. If you follow me or you don't. I don't care about having 100,000 followers. I don't care about having a blue check. I don't care about none of that. I care about just people respecting me and my music, because that's at the end of the day, when the social media should go away, what's left? Me and the music. You know what I'm saying?
And one thing artists
have like straight
feed
is they take this thing away. You see how when Instagram was down for like a couple hours, how panicking people were acting.
Panicking. panicked. They didn't know what to do. They forgot how to go hang in the park. They forgot how to go play basketball. They forgot how to go just chill and just, you know, calm. They forgot how to conversate. They forgot how to conversate, man. They forgot how to just chill. You know, back in the days when we was growing up, we had to go to the park. We played skelzies. You know, we played stickball in the street. We did things like that. But now it's like you come home, you jumping online. You're going right online. So are you playing video games that's a part of social media's network? All that shit is all that. Everything is built together, man. Everything.
So I can't. Like, and they come home from school, but it's like, damn, they don't even hug moms, yo. They go straight to the game.
Straight to the game or straight on Facebook or Instagram or they go do a little Twitter video. I mean, TikTok is another thing. That shit got kids going crazy. You got older people spend all day long on TikTok trying to get 1 million views. It's like everybody's trying to be a social media star instead of trying to be themselves and live a real life. Like, you know, if you're going to do the TikTok thing, do something that's going to help somebody. Like, all these rappers, no disrespect to them, but they're not teaching me nothing. What do Megan is teaching kids how to be a hoe. All the other little rappers teaching kids how to go out there and drink lean and shoot guns and kill each other. Like, you know, even if you're a gangster rapper, teach me why I shouldn't be in the street. Or teach me how to be in the street. Like, damn, if you're a gangster rapper, show me how to be a gangster rapper. Then teach me that shit. Don't teach me how to just kill somebody. That's why I can't stand this era, because it don't make sense to me. It don't make sense. It doesn't. It don't make sense, man.
Nah, man. Nah, man, because you got to get – we used to get different shades of the coin now, because back then they would tell you the repercussions of the dope game or the repercussions. Because, mm-hmm. you know, you had them songs that – like, you know how Beanie Siegel had a song, Tell Me What Your Life Like, where he gave you the whole
that was it.
Present.
That was it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I remember hearing thing, that. I'm like, man, I ain't trying to go to that shit.
Yeah, love's gonna get you. Shit like that. Like, love's gonna get you where he told you about how his brother wanted to sell drugs like him, and then they ended up getting shot up. And he did it out of love. See, it was simple. Now it's like, I don't understand what they're saying. They talking about a bunch of jewelry and cars, and everybody's rap is jewelry, cars, and this is repetitive, man. It's redundant, and this is boring. It's just boring to me.
It's like people, what they're doing now is they're basically trying to live up to that character that they portray themselves. They can't show any form of humanity.
Nope. They barbaric.
Yeah. You know, when we look at what's come this era, because we're looking at a situation where a lot of this generation, you know, we're looking at a lot of the young kids. We're not saying this is grumpy old men. We're saying this as elders who love our babies, you know, right, and are concerned about where our babies are coming. Because we're seeing a lot of these young kids, you know, looking at some of these internet models as being a thing to have. And I don't want, I'm only saying this from a journalistic perspective. It's not to air them out. It's like what happened, you know, with PJ Washington, with this situation he got with Brittany going on, Brittany Renner. And, you know, Brittany had already kind of had a rep online in terms of being an internet chick. I don't know how they got together. Brittany even said it herself that she was basically talking this dude, like going to games in Kentucky. She was like, she was going to get him. And she got him, and then we see the fuckery that ensued from it. And it's like, I don't think TJ really understood what he was getting himself into dealing with her. You know,
right.
For those that ain't seen Brittany Renner's IG, you can see that, she's different and not in a good way.
Mental illness is a problem.
Yeah, yeah. What my brother said. When we get back into the music aspect of it, Hitman, you made such a great point, you and King both, because when we look at artists that are really out there, if your music is dope, it's going to reach organically, you know, whether it's yourself, whether it's Cam and Shauna in Inglewood, G Perico in South Central. you know, Kamaya out in Oakland, AD, you know, in LA, you know, there are just so many are BMF Cash, you know, down in Atlanta. Shout out to him. You know, we're going to have him on in a couple weeks. You know, it's about having an organic flow that your music really connects with your audience in a real way. And that cannot be bought or manufactured in any capacity, people who really rock with you. A lot of people try to use social media numbers as a barometer for popularity, but a lot of times it's hollow if it doesn't really mean anything, if it's not resonating. And I think artists need to understand that. You know, it's not hate if people aren't with your shit. It just means your shit may not be good enough. But if your music is good, it's going to find somebody, and it's going to be respected, and it's going to be celebrated, and it will be consumed.
It's going to find its way into people's hearts and people's houses. It's going to find the music. If the music is good, like you said, it's going to find its own way.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
You know.
And but the problem is we've seen with social media is now everybody feels like because someone became a celebrity, because this is what people have to understand about it. Your trek is not somebody else's journey.
Right.
Their journey is not going to be your exploration. Everybody has a different path that they walk to get to their destination. And what we're seeing now with this proliferation of it, does this mean we're against social media? Absolutely not. We use this media. This is what we do on the show. We like to think we use it responsibly. But now you have irresponsible individuals because you're always going to have that asshole in the audience that always gets it wrong, and it ain't cute. You have a situation where individuals think, well, because somebody got famous, well, goddammit, I deserve to be famous too. Well, did you look at the reason why they became famous? Did you look at what they did, and did they really deserve it? Are they being celebrated or are they being clowned for their stupidity, or are they being celebrated for their innovativeness? Now we have a desperation, like you said, Hitman, of how everybody wants to be out there. They want to put all their business out there. Coming from the block, man, you know, we know certain things that ain't just for people to know.
That's right.
That's how we move.
Certain things
you
keep quiet.
Yeah. It's like, you know, King and myself, we put stuff out there, but we don't put every aspect of our lives out there. You know, we don't need to have everything out there about what we do, you know, which chicks we knocking off or which rapper we done spoke to today, unless it's business related. You know, we don't make it a point to broadcast everything from two reasons. Number one, we're not that self-absorbed and vain. And number two, if our haters out there, we got a couple, but fuck them. If they don't know what we're doing, they can't sabotage what we're doing.
Exactly. I love that. And so now that right there was some beautiful words, because I told my brother that too. I said, if they don't know what you're doing, they can't sabotage what you're doing. When you put too much information out there, like, you know, I might put a couple of videos up when I'm on a plane and shit like that. That's just for certain people, like my fans that want to see that. But I don't normally do that all the time. You know, I just do it when I need to do it. But when you put too much out there, the hate builds up.
Yeah.
You know, so it's good to keep it low key and quiet. Let them find out about it later.
Yeah. You know, everybody think that they stunting hard, when they put out money and jewels. So I'm like, dude, you're going to end up like Evel Knievel crash landing, because it's like,
that's right.
When you got, you know, when you put out that stuff, you know, it is something that you're a target. You become a target after that. I mean, look, shout out to Griselda with Benny the Butcher, Westside Gunn, Armani Caesar, Boldy James, all of them. And I love those guys. King will tell you that. But, you know, as thorough as Benny is, and we know those guys are real street, Benny be rocking. He be heavy. And, you know, Benny is a real dude out of Buffalo. And that didn't stop those haters from trying to jack him. And I think they did get him when they shot him. And they got him, too. So it's like if a real street nigga like Benny can get got,
And thank God he's still with us, because, and for those that ain't heard that new joint, yes, I'm going to shamelessly plug it right fast, but that joint, he ain't, for y'all who haven't heard that new joint he got coming with Snoop Dogg, check it out, because he's also got another song with Red Cafe coming too. So, yeah, check it out, because the shit is, but I mean, but if, people got to understand, if real street dudes can get touched out there with those wolves, somebody who ain't even from the block, what do you think they're going to do to someone who not even from the block and they try to perpetrate like they really big dog status? And then they get put down like Sounder.
Say it one more time, please.
You know, I said people got to understand. They, I'm like, if someone like Benny, if they're gonna, if you got people out there that are going to target a real street dude like Benny and try to, you know, rob him, what do you think they're going to do to somebody who's perpetrating, and that dude, you know, he thinks he's a big dog, and then he gets put down like, you know, Sounder or Old Yeller. You know,
right. You know, it's like
they run up on
they look him. At it like, they look at it like if they rob, they rob any, like, you know, popular dude that got a heavy chest on, a heavy neck on, they rob them, they get popular. You know what I'm saying? They rob them, they get popular. So that's how that game works. You know, when they all claimed they was trying to, when 6ix9ine was going to the different places and seeing he was there and this and that and third, he just trolling, you know, that was a money move. That was a money move. You know, he knew that he could have got hurt. But, you know, YouTube was loving it because the views was there and, you know, the algorithm was going up. And that algorithm is basically money. You know,
right.
So that's what a lot of these dudes do. They want to go ride around with guns in their cars and run up on somebody and film it and put it on there, knowing it's going to get a lot of views. Now they get the check. So now they found out they could get paid from YouTube, and YouTube is like, fuck it, you know, we getting half of that money anyway. Let them do whatever. You know, so the game is just turned upside down, man. You know.
Yeah, it is. But that's why I would tell anybody, you know, if you really, you know, if you out there and you really thorough with it, never give your enemy a chance to prepare. If you got them M4s and them AKs in the back, you don't necessarily have to show them. Let the niggas that test you get an unpleasant surprise if they try to run up, and let that be a lesson to anybody else that tries to run up. You know what I'm saying? Because there's plenty of dudes out there. I tell anyone, you know, a lot of these dudes out there that don't put it out there online, I'm like, don't think they not with the shit. It's just that they understand what you put out there. Like you said earlier, Hitman, life and death is in the tongue. Actions, in terms of what you articulate, can be actuality. And if you are not careful what you express out there, it can bring about a real tragedy. You know, I think it's just common sense not to invite ignorance into your life, because it'll erase your life, possibly. You know, obviously you've been doing work. Who would you like to work with as you progressed in this musical journey, you know, of excellence, you know, for the years? Who would you like to, you know, do collaborations with? Who have you reached out to?
Like Kendrick Lamar, definitely Macadocious from the Outlaws. Love to use Nat Turnal. That was Dre's artist. De La Soul, Old School Cat, Special Ed. Also, you know, of course, Nice and Smooth. I love to work with like MC Light, Sugar T. You know, legends, young guys. I work with the Baby. Lil Baby is definitely one person I work with. Lil Baby, I love his style because he's different, you know. And you know, that's about it for right now, you know. Yeah.
And I mean, pretty much when you look at it from a perspective of when you got individuals now who, you just look at where hip-hop is in such a creative space right now in terms of certain artists relying on a lot of shameless shenanigans of just over-the-topness, I think, to overcompensate for, you know, mediocre talent. You may get an idea of who I'm implying when I say this.
What do you feel about how people try to use a lot of sensationalism to sell rather than real substance of talent? Instead
well,
of making crazy-ass
you know,
videos. Yeah.
You know, they don't really, you know, if you have a talented person doing a video, then you don't have to use all the cars and the females and all that. They use the substance, the cars and the females and the fake mansions and the fake jewelry because there's no talent there. So that you know, when you look at a video, you're actually not listening to what they're saying. You're looking at what they're doing and what they got, that Lamborghini, that Porsche. So it takes away from you hearing that record and what that person really doing on that record. So that's like
right.
that's called an illusion. It's a major illusion. You know, major illusion. You see the fake money they ordered from China. You know, they got the fake money in the videos and the bottles that they know they can't afford. But it looks so good on TV where the audience be like, oh, they get money. You know, you could rent these mansions for $1,500 a month. You know, you could rent them bed and bath, you know, breakfast and bed mansions. They get those and they front with like it's theirs, knowing it's not. You know, everybody want to have the big, oh, I got a $10 million house. I mean, you got homeless out here. You got hungry. You see Skid Row lately? Skid Row is crazy, but you got a $10 million house. You can't help Skid Row? So I don't pay that no attention, man. I just be like, okay, whatever. You know, that's how I do it.
Yeah, a lot of times it just becomes excess, you know, and I think that's something where I think anytime we see the human element of what people get in terms of what they've done, which is deserved in terms of, my thing is if you worked hard for it, you have a right to spend it how you want. I've always implored those who have it to spend and save responsibly and not necessarily be ostentatious in their, you know, displays of it. I think there's a level of modesty that just denotes a level of maturity and decorum. That is not always something I think people have because at the end of the day, people are going to judge you by how you impacted their life with what your music is. But even more, I think, with music, I think it's better to be a decent individual that makes great music, you know, than to be a shitty person that makes great music. You know, your character is what will be the continuation of your legacy. Your actions.
There's a lot of scumbags in this business too, man. But they have to be talented.
Yeah, there are. Yeah.
It is. It's a lot of negative.
Yeah,
there's a lot of people that will. There's a lot of people that will convince you that it's going to be this way, and lure you in. And then a lot of dudes are not reading these contracts, and the fine print in these contracts is being like, "I own you." You know, you're getting from an Apple streaming, to stream a song on Apple, artists are getting 1 cent. But you claim you're a star, but you're getting one. It went from getting 40 cents a record to 1 cent a stream. Remember back when we had vinyls and cassettes? It was getting about a dollar a record, probably 80 cents a record. You getting 1 cent a stream? Come on, man.
We did an interview with Young Con the Don a couple years ago from St. Louis. One of the best interviews we've ever done, and he broke down the science of the streaming. I don't know how long this dude studied that shit, but when he broke down the numbers to us, me and King still talk about that to this day. How he broke down the mathematics.
Yeah, I'm about to upload that clip,
paid.
Man. I'm gonna have to find that. I'm about to upload that clip just for knowledgeable purposes.
Yeah. But, and when we talk about, because then also, too, we got a little bit of time left, but when we talk about records and everything, King and myself have always been proponents of physicals in terms of maintaining CDs and cassettes, in terms of streaming. People got lazy when it became to streaming because it became more convenient, but I'm like, when you look at what's happening with streaming, what is it?
They're taking all your records down.
Yeah, I mean, look. We're just going to, I mean, keeping it real because it happened a couple of days ago with R. Kelly. You know what I'm saying? You know, and obviously we're not defending what he did, but it's like, you know, he's in a situation now where his shit's probably going to possibly could get taken down depending on how they want to carry it on streaming. And with his conviction, they have a right to do it, you know? I mean,
then they get right
to it. They got Ratio Catalog within a button.
They haven't. Well, they haven't sent us some yet. They haven't sent us some yet. He gets sentenced next year in May. Go ahead.
You know something? He set himself up for that. You know, if he knew he had an issue with little girls and he knew he had a problem with his mind, I don't think R. Kelly. Well, I mean, I'm not trying to defend him. I'm not defending the women. I just don't think that he was a rapist. I think that his mind didn't grow up. It's like this. If you know psychology, a mind has to grow into its age. You understand? And his mind probably still was a younger mind. Even though he was an older man, he had a younger mind. You know, and them women, the young girls probably was fit the way his mind were, and they probably was built a certain way at the time. And you know, but for him to do all them women like he did them was wrong. Yes, it was. But don't you think we should take the man and get some help to see what's wrong with his mind first before you know? I mean, it's a crime, but a mind is a mind, and I feel like they didn't try to evaluate his mental first. See what's wrong with this man, because he could come out of jail, he could get paroled 40 years later and do the same thing. You know, and by him being in there, it's not going to help no better. You know, they made millions of dollars off this black man from singing. Millions of dollars off this black man. But as soon as this shit happened, everybody turned their back. But before, when he was making millions of dollars feeding y'all kids and buying y'all all these big-ass houses and these land, y'all was happy with him. And how you know if they ain't sending the women in? Right,
that's going to be a different conversation here, man. Because when you look at it, we've always
been in the
industry.
Not to mention, that's real deep if you really build on that. Because,
right,
you also see like when somebody's not developing to an adult state of mind, you go by how the women he keep around. Just like a lot of the girlfriends, he would have like they always like 20s and stuff like that.
Right,
in my mind,
right,
I was thinking. Right. And in my mind, I'm thinking, when the hell would I have in common with a 20-year-old? You know what I'm saying? So it's
a grown man.
And you know, that's a deeper conversation. You know, that's another conversation here in King, because when you look at it, y'all are absolutely right. Because when you're looking at the entertainment industry in general, we all agree what he did was wrong. And then the questions are, the people that were around, it's like you knew this was happening, and you know, y'all basically through your silence, you were complicit. You know, that's going to be a deeper mess to get through in terms of who was benefiting from all of this, because we got to look through the minutiae of the enablers. We have to look at some of these parents in terms of who legitimately knew what was going on, who did not know what was going on. It's a lot. I mean, this whole thing is just a big mess. And, the reality is that he's not the only one out there. We've talked to some people, we won't name no names, who know what goes on in the industry. A good friend of ours, they gave us some stories with some people out there who, you know, have had a penchant, you know, for underage girls, you know, and this has always gone on. You know, we're obviously not going to put names out there. That's not the type of journalism we do on this show. But when you get into that Hollywood lifestyle, there's a lot that goes on. You know, and it's not always good. I'll just leave it at that. And we don't want to get cut off from blog talk. Hitman, this has been tremendous. We have thoroughly enjoyed having you and Smooth be on this show. You know, y'all are welcome back anytime. It goes without question. King and myself, we've enjoyed this. Before we sign out, tell everybody what you got moving on the airways and where everybody can find you on social media.
Okay, you can find me on Instagram at The Real K Davis the Hitman. On Facebook is Manson with an E, Bates with a Z. And my Twitter is K Davis the Hitman. TikTok is K Davis the Hitman. And YouTube, same thing, y'all, K Davis the Hitman. And my website is www.kdavisthehitman.com. And you can find all my latest music on Apple Music right now. Or you can go on Spotify and type in K Davis the Hitman, and you'll see my previous records that came out. And I got a couple of albums. I did 21 mixtapes, but all of them is to, like, spread it out. You go on YouTube and type in Manson Bates, M-A-N-S-O-N-E-B-A-T-E-Z, and that's my previous work like a couple of years back. Or let's say with K. Davis the Hitman, see my new work. Brand new single I'm focusing on right now is called That Ass to the Floor. And I got the backup records called The U and the Diamond. But That Ass to the Floor is what I'm running with y'all. So check it out. Go give me a stream on Apple Music. Just listen to it. Share it with your friends. It's on SoundCloud as well. You know, if you want to book Manson Bakes or, you know, K. Davis to hit me, if you want to book me, you could hit me up on my Gmail at manson.bates@gmail.com, at manson.bates@gmail.com. You know, or, you know, and then we can get it like that, man.
Definitely, and there it is.
We're going to definitely keep
thank
it
you, y'all.
Smooth, man, as y'all continue to build the process.
Definitely. We got some good music coming y'all way.
Yep.
All right,
peace, y'all. On that note, we signing out. Peace, y'all.
Peace.